I know that he comes to us from the Living in the Solution group at St. Luke's Lutheran Church. I believe that's out on Northside Drive somewhere. And so please welcome Sam M.
My name's Sam. I'm an alcoholic. That last thing was kind of a warning. I thought you might have added it just for me. I did say I was an alcoholic, I think. And I got sober at the 8111 Club in October 25th, 1988. But years before that, I've told some of you this before. I got my home groupies over here, and they're here. That's the Truth Squad, and they would call me on anything if I get off track, I'm sure. They'll let me know later, at least. Years before I knew anything about AA, I had almost 15 years sobriety, and then I turned 15, and I started drinking, and I was kind of a pretty average kid, you know. I mean, I played sports some. I was small, but I was slow. Is that what they said about me on the football team? And I was a good student. I was adequately smart for South Georgia, where I grew up, at least. In fact, I grew up in the biggest county in the state, Ware County, which is where Waycross is, and half of the county is in the Okefenokee Swamp, but I didn't tell most people that. I'm telling you that, but don't tell anybody. It was a pretty much average childhood. My family was a little on the positive side as far as dysfunctional. I remember when I was about 11 or 12 counseling them about marriage, my parents, I don't know that how many 12-year-olds counsel their parents about their marriage, and I suggested maybe they ought to go live apart because they didn't seem to live together very well at all. And they were probably singularly unfitted for each other. But my parents died last year and a couple of years ago, and so my sister and brother and I had some recollections of life over the years, and we all agreed that probably they just weren't suited for each other. But that had nothing to do with my drinking, or very little to do with my drinking. But I started drinking when I was about 15, 16. Drank on the weekends. I guess I was in about the 10th grade or 9th grade when I started drinking, and it was a liberating thing. It was free at last, and I'm telling you, I started drinking alcoholically when I first started drinking. I would drink till I passed out, and we had one good friend. His father kept the bottle of vodka underneath the seat of the car, and we did the old drink the vodka, fill it up with water. I mean, I'm sure that he probably thought, I'm going crazy, I can't get drunk anymore. But, I'm sure a lot of people have done that. I drank through high school, and I continued to make pretty good grades. I think I rode on my reputation somewhat. I got started pretty good, and I did limit my drinking at that time, and I was In fact, they had a pretty good high school career. I got a scholarship to college. I got a scholarship to Emory and an academic scholarship, which because they don't have that many football scholarships out there. But I felt fortunate to get a scholarship to Emory, and my parents were related, and so I was off to college, but I couldn't wait to go drinking. I was out of the control or in the eye of the parents and the others in the community, and I got to Atlanta, and before I got to my first class at college, I found somebody who wanted to go drinking, and we got a bottle of scotch, and I wanted to do something really nice because I was in the big city, so I got some Hawaiian punch to mix with it. We got so drunk and such a bad hangover, I decided Hawaiian punch wouldn't work with scotch anymore, and I never did it again. But I tried it with vodka and gin and every other imaginable combination over the years. But I did okay in school, just, you know, average, but average at Emory at that time was okay. But my buddies that went to Georgia said, "Sam, you working so hard, you can come over to Georgia. You can drink all the time and still make passing grades." And I said, "Save me a place in the fraternity house." And so I jumped at the chance and got over there. And it was so much cheaper to go to school there at the time that it was a net gain for me. And I got a job and generally had a job in college and worked in the summers up in the mountains in a hotel. And drank my way through college. I finally got to the point where at the time you could go to law school without having a degree in college, and so I somehow or other got that figured out and got to my first year in law school, and I was what you'd call a very uncommitted student, and I just barely got by. I barely got to class is what I mean, and sometimes didn't make the class. I still have those nightmares about not remembering that I had a class and not remembering where it was and not remembering halfway through the quarter whether I was in the class or not. It was about that bad in my college, my last college year at in law school. So I decided that was going to work for me. And during that time, you know, drinking was such a major part of my college career. It was the thing to do. I lived in a hotel that had a beer machine in the lobby, and you put 50 cents in it and you get a beer. You know, it was just different in Athens in those years. The professors in law school especially would assign 200 pages, and I'd read about three pages, and I'd say, "I got to go to Allen's and drink some beer and think about this stuff." So it wasn't a really successful legal career, and so I didn't know what to do after that. I decided I'd go join the Army. They were about to draft me if I didn't join, and so I joined, and actually, I got a, is it the miraculous thing in my life, and nothing short of miraculous, I think. I applied for something. I had known some other friends who had done it, and it's something that hear the joke all the time, it's an impossibility, it's an oxymoron, but I applied for something called Army Intelligence. And they turned me down. Well, they said there's no availability. And the strangest thing happened in my life at that point. It was a big deal for me in looking back at my life. I was telling the guys earlier, I got a job temporarily waiting to go in the Army. They just said, take something, Sam, and go to OCS and deal with it later. And Vietnam was going on along that time, and I wasn't really too interested in being in infantry. So I was waiting, and I got a job at Stouffer Top of the Mart, which was a big fancy restaurant in Atlanta at that time. And I got up there, and I walked in, and I was interviewing for the job, and the general manager came out of the back office and said, I know you. We stayed in your hotel in the mountains. And said, I give you a job. You're going to get on my management training program. And I said, I'm going in the Army 3 months from now. And he said, it's okay, we'll put you on the training program. It'll be good for you. We'll work you around all over the restaurant. You can cook. You can do everything. We'll just teach you all we know. And about the third slot they got me to was the bar. And I said, I'll be good here until I go in the Army. Just leave me here. So I was drunk all the time on Stouffer's money until I got in the Army. It was another one of those. Well, at the time, I thought it was just a miracle. It was God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. Actually, I managed to get by and got in the Army. And during that time, interestingly, somebody called me up and said, you know, I need to talk to you. I'm out at Fort McPherson, and I was just thumbing through the records. Now, I don't know how this happened, but I've always wondered. But he said, you know, you had pretty good test scores, and so I wonder if you'd be interested in being in Army Intelligence. And I said, man, would I? I mean, that was what I applied for, but, you know, they said no openings. They said, don't worry about it. We'll get you in. So that's what I ended up doing. I went to basic training, and then I went to intelligence school up in Baltimore, and I was doing really well there. And one morning, though, they had put me in charge of the class to get them to the various classrooms, and they couldn't find me one morning, and I had passed out in the stall in the restroom, and just couldn't make it to formation. I'd just fallen over on the side of the stall and passed out, and so I almost got thrown out of the school. Somehow or other, I didn't. And so I finished that up, and I had a great career in the Army. It was 3 years, and I went to Germany, held off the Germans while the Vietnam was going on, and I was over there. I had a good job. I mean, it was very interesting work, and we had a lot of, as teams, we worked as teams, and as we were, we had autonomy you can't believe. My teammate and I would go do something, and we'd just decide what we're going to do about 80% of the time. And about 70% of that 80% was nothing. And so we would go select something we were going to do, investigate or whatever, and then we'd do that in the morning, then we'd take a break from about 11 until about 5, and then we'd have a reason to do something else for an hour or two. And then we would drink through lunch, and that was our routine generally, unless we were taking 3-day holidays and whatever. I was making enough money to live on nicely, and but there was a ski school in Bavaria, that a resort that available to the military, and And it costs $70 to go for a week, including housing, food, ski rental, ski lift tickets, everything. And I never could get $70 together because I was drunk every night. And drinking in Germany, even in Germany, costs money. And I wonder, you know, what would I have seen? What would I have done? What travel would I have enjoyed had I not been drinking all the time? But I was drinking was my thing. I didn't know what I didn't know. You know, that was it. I just was, it was just the most important thing. And I didn't hang with the guys that didn't drink. He'd go back and I'd think, these poor wimps sitting here reading a book and I'm out there having fun, you know. So anyway, I finally got out of the Army after a very, very nice time. Came back to D.C. and worked there for a year, and also didn't go to most of the places that you think you would go to if you lived in D.C., but I knew every bar in Georgetown, and I worked in a bar there as well, and that was just my life. And at that point, I was still in Army Intelligence, and there were a lot of clearances and, you know, all sorts of security clearances, and I started getting paranoid, and I knew people were watching me, and they were outside my apartment, and it was just like that paranoia was just washing over me at that time. And but I finally got out of the Army, got back to Georgia, went to over to Athens, and got back in school, and miraculously I finished in a couple of quarters because I actually studied, and it was a different dynamic for me. And so I got out of Georgia, and came to Atlanta, got a job in the restaurant business where you could drink. And I had a good rationale because I saved them so much money in other areas that I never felt like it was bad to drink all their booze after hours. And so that was just the way it worked, you know. It was logical to me. So I got married and divorced 3 or 4 years later. I never can quite keep up with how long I've been married or divorced, but I've been divorced a lot more than I've been married over the years. And probably wouldn't have gotten divorced if I hadn't been drinking, but then again, I might not have gotten married if I hadn't been drinking. That's an old joke, but I like it. But I would tell my wife, and she was a good person, and the first one, you know, alcoholics often say, was that the first wife or the second wife or the third wife? And but in my case, the first one was very a good person, you know, and I would call. I got in the real estate business about that time, and actually put drinking aside for a little bit and went out and made some money. And she thought, this guy is going to make money all the time. Well, then I had to stay in the bars because that's where the business was done. And I'd say, I'll be home about 7. That's great. I'm cooking dinner. And about 8, I would call, and I would say, I ran into some guys. I got to spend some time here at the Red Lion, I think it was at the time. And then she would call me back about 8:30 and say, I thought you said you'd be here at 8 or 9 or whatever it was. And it's like, look, you don't understand my business. I've got to do what I've got to do. And this is my business. This is how it works. But I'll be there in 30 minutes. And it was only 10 minutes away. And then I wouldn't be there, and I wouldn't call. And I'd call her about 11 or 12, and I'd say, my favorite line, and I always like this line. I'd say, "From the runway, I'm bringing it in," and she would never laugh. Never thought it was funny. And I tell you, when we do, I mean, you know, I like that in AA they say we talk about sad things and everybody laughs, and we talk about really happy things and everybody cries, you know. And that's what, I think that's kind of the way we handle the pain that's there. That's the way I handle it. But I was very unfair to her, and she, one night I got home, and I remember getting home, and I remember she wasn't there, and then at midnight she wasn't there, and at 1 and at 2, and I was distraught, so I drank some just to calm my nerves, and but she never came home, and the next day she came rolling in and said, you know, "That's what it's like." And I said, "Yes, but I'm a man, you know, women can't do..." You know, I was so confused about everything in life. And so anyway, I had an office downtown the second year I was in real estate, and I got in my car downtown. I exited at Howell Mill Road on 75. That's 3-4 miles, whatever. I would get so nervous driving. It was that paranoia that, and I just couldn't handle driving on the expressway. So I'd get off and creep along these back roads, and I didn't know then what I know now about alcoholism. It was just beginning to really affect my mental state. And but to me, it was just something to deal with and get over, and you know, and it was not manly to worry about driving on the highway. You know, it was just the way things were, and I had no compass. I had nobody to tell me that I was totally wrong about how I was living my life, and so. Muddled on through that. We had a son. He was about 4 months old. Well, when he was born, I couldn't wait for the childbirth. And it kept getting delayed and delayed. Finally, she gave birth about 8:30 in the morning. I raced on over to the Lion's Head, and that's what it was, the Lion's Head. And they weren't open yet. I mean, you know, and I'm needing a drink. And I waited around and got drunk there and celebrated the birth of my son. And that was what I thought I should do. It was an important milestone, and I should celebrate. Anyway, when he was 4 months old, his mother said, "I'm not living like this. I'm not there. We've got responsibilities for children," and finally Dan, only 4 months old, packed up and moved to Chicago, and she went with him. You know? Anyway, that you know, my attitude wasn't how can we work this out. It was, you know, get the hell out if you're going to be that way. If you're not loyal to me, you know, in this crisis that I'm going through, and it was all about business and had nothing to do with drinking. Why do I want you around? And so, you know, I just didn't know how to deal with life. I didn't learn. And alcohol almost never helps, you know, clear thinking. It certainly did in my mind. So I would get so confused about things, and I muddled on through for, that ended up in a divorce, and then I got married again, and I got divorced again, and you know, it was just chaos in my life, and I didn't know that I was creating it all. It was always somebody else's fault, some business situation that was their fault. wives or girlfriends, whichever at the time. I got so confused drinking and worrying about relationships, I would get the women confused about who said what, and I would, you know, I would give this one this thing that she said and realized later that no, that wasn't the one that said it, it was this one. And it was like I got all these women together and it was like Mega Woman beating the hell out of me, you know. I just couldn't get it. I couldn't get my thoughts together. I couldn't deal with life. And that went on for a while, and then we got another divorce there, and I like to say the second wife, her dad was an alcoholic, and so he and I got along famously. We would go to the Falcon game and wonder later who won and that sort of thing, and get kicked out of bars after the game because we were too drunk to come in the bar, and you know, those just those typical things. But we, you know, through it all, I maintained that I wasn't having problems with alcohol. Alcohol wasn't my problem. It was all these other things that were my problems. And so on, when I was about 2 years before I got sober, I was just so confused, and alcohol was so compelling. I couldn't get by without the alcohol every day. And so I was living with someone at that time. We had bought this house together, and that relationship just dissolved. And we were still living in the same house, but it dissolved. There was no relationship. And finally, I thought there were problems, and then I really understood. I understood there was really a problem, because I went home and she had had all the locks changed on the doors, and so I knew that she was serious about things. And I, since I couldn't get in the house anymore, I figured I wasn't living there. And that was close to the bottom for me. I knew my family, I wasn't communicating with them. This relationship that I thought was so important didn't exist. And some of this I knew at the time, and some of this I know now looking back at it. And so I was just that far from the bottom. And I went to this therapist, thinking I was going to put the relationship back together, and all she wanted to talk about was alcoholism, and I thought, that's a ridiculous thing. I came here for good advice and constructive criticism, and you're talking about alcoholism? In fact, somebody else already told me that I was an alcoholic. I don't need to hear it from you. But she did. I did tell her at the time, I said, but I think I'm losing touch with reality. I think I'm about snap. I think I'm about to go. You know, I don't know what is going to happen. And she told me, and I was telling some people this earlier, she told me I needed to get something. I mean, and she said, well, a lot of people do use AA chips, but she said, get something to hold on to, because you might need to reach in your pocket and have that. And so I did. I got a little rock and I carried it around with me, and I still got that little rock. And it was a good thing I had it, because I was down to my last woe is me. I was ready. And I'm not looking back at it now and saying this. I didn't know all this at the time, but I decided I can save myself. I could go. If I went to pick up my laundry and somebody leaned over and said something to someone else in the laundry, I knew they were talking about me. I knew. I mean, in a paranoia, At the time, in the real estate world, you go to the courthouse and you do research, and these guys across the room would be leaning over saying something, and they were talking about me. It was as real as if it was real. Anyway, I said, I got to do something that makes sense. I'll go on a group outing. So I signed up to go to a hike up in the mountains, which I think is, you know, I like it. I like that part of my story. And up in the mountains is where you get clarity. You know, up in the mountains is where it all comes together. Well, I'm up there, and I get hooked up. Everybody is paired up, and everybody's riding together. And they said, Sam, we don't really have any more room. And then this lady came driving up, and they said, oh, yeah, you can ride with Jane. Jane is good. You will enjoy that. Jane was wacky. Jane had more problems than I had, and I knew that 10 miles out of town. And so we were going up to Cloudland Canyon, just south of Chattanooga there, and Jane was navigating and I was driving. And when we got into downtown Chattanooga, I knew that she wasn't very good at navigating. So we finally circled back, and she was a mess. I'm telling you, I mean, as bad as I was, I knew that she was worse. And so we got there, and we found the group, and she bolted to the other side of the group. I never saw her again, never talked to her, and I was so grateful. But I was walking along there. I was walking along there with this lady. I mean, with this crowd, and I said, I could die right now and just fall off the side here and nobody would know and nobody would care. You know, I really felt that it was a reality. You know, I don't think I thought about jumping. I'm kind of glad I didn't. I might have done it. But there were a couple of good jump-offs up there. But anyway, I'm walking along there and this lady comes over and chats with me. And I figured, I got a bottle of water, and she wants some of the water I have, which I did offer, and she did drink some water. And we had a nice conversation. We decided we would come back, and when we got back to Atlanta, we would go out to dinner. Just, I know this is dragging it out, but it was important to me at the time, and it's important to me now, and I don't want to forget it. But at dinner, I told her, I think I drink too much. Yeah, that's like, whoa, what a revelation. So she wasn't drinking, and I thought that was so nice that she didn't drink because I wasn't drinking. And we had a nice dinner, went for a little walk, never met her before. She got in her car, she was closing the door, and she said, I don't know if I should tell you this, but Wednesday, and I'm overly emotional, and you know, I'm in that category of those people who, you know, we're, some of us AAs are overly sensitive. I'm still there. It takes a long time to overcome that serious handicap, says in the book, and I'm still working on it. But anyway, so she said, I'm celebrating my 5th anniversary in AA on Wednesday. This was a Sunday. And I said, great, I'll go with you. And she said, being 5 years sober, she said, no, I don't think you will. And she said, I'll get my cousin, this guy, to call you and talk to you about AA if you'd like for me to. And he did, and he became my first sponsor. Although then I was burning with desire to get sober. And so he couldn't meet until Thursday. So I went to a meeting on Wednesday, and I walked into that first meeting, and I thought, well, there are a bunch of kids here. There are no people my age, just kids. And I found out later that it was a young people's meeting. And but at the time, I thought, man, I don't think I'll fit in on this thing. And but by the way, I like the vertical integration, I call it. You know, I like the guys as old as I am and guys that are 14 years old, you know, all trying to get sober, and we're each helping each other be sober. But those are things I've picked up over the years and didn't have much clarity at all then, but I did, there was a guy behind me who was with his parents had brought him to the meeting, and they said it was his first meeting ever, and I thought to myself, I hope he's listening because he needs some of this stuff. I didn't think I needed it, but I thought, this is good stuff, he could use this. So anyway, I and additionally, I was the only one there with a coat and tie on, and so I felt like I was a little bit more organized and a little bit more clear about things than those people that were sitting around with all sorts of things on. And I just didn't know anything about AA. I didn't know, but I did know that I threw a $20 bill in the basket, and I thought, they'll see that. They'll know they're dealing with somebody of substance here. Anyway, at the time, I think that was half of my net worth, but I wanted to make a good impression. So, but I went out to my car, and I sat there, and I said, as clear as I say it now, I knew there was a way out. It was big. I mean, because I didn't think there was a way out. I didn't think that there was a way out of the ruin I'd made of my life. And it was so simple. You know, if I just stopped drinking, then, and I did, and I'm not saying that I, you know, embraced AA totally. But I didn't know what else to do. I mean, I had no other direction to go. And so I started going to meetings, and I went to a lot of meetings. And I go to 8111. They had morning meetings, and they had noon meetings, and they had night meetings, and I'd be on my way to a meeting, and then I'd say, oh, I gotta go home and get some things done. I'd turn my car around, I'd be going back home, and I'd say, no, I gotta go to that meeting. I'd turn back around. It was a lot of confusion at that time, no doubt about it. And but I hung around and had about 3 or 4 months sober, and this young lady that I'd met, I was younger then, young ladies would talk to me at least then, and so she said, Sam, I think this is working for you, or you have no concept of the severity of your problem. And I've often said it could still be true that that's the case now. But I got in it, and I heard somebody say the other day, he didn't get sober until he got in AA. He came and hung around the edges, and he went to a few meetings, but he never got in it. He never embraced it. He never said, you know, this is what I need to do. But for some reason, and it's not because I was smart enough, but it was probably because I was at the bottom. I got involved in it, and I loved it, and it was difficult my first year, especially. I mean, some days I'd say, you know, I just need to stay in bed. I just need to keep covers over me and have somebody slide me a sandwich at lunch, you know. But I had these a few people I knew that would call and check on me, and had another buddy that I used to drink with, and he'd been trying to get sober for 11 years, and he'd get 30 days and 20 days, and he told me he never got 90 days, but 11 years he'd been going through that madness, and so he and I got sober about the same time and got to the same meeting, just another little miracle. And he and I would call up, and we would yell and scream at each other, and one of us would say, look, I mean, you know, if you feel that way, don't bother calling me again. And about 2 hours later, we'd be on the phone, you know. That guy I still talk to almost every day almost every day. And as I've said often, I don't know why, because I don't even like him that much. But we're buddies. And I'm telling you, if you don't get that in AA, it's a long and lonely road. So I go to a lot of meetings, not because I have to or not because I'm going to go drink if I don't, but I like to go, and I like the idea that we do have that obligation to pay back those people who were there and say, Sam, don't worry about all that stuff. I was an intellectual in AA. I mean, I would analyze, you know, the discussions, and I would want to. I couldn't talk in a meeting at all. I'd get right here, and I couldn't say a word. I mean, it was just like God doing for you what he couldn't do, you know, for me. But God was keeping me quiet until it was time to talk. But I would want to talk after the meeting and describe all these fallacies of reasoning and so forth. And they say, Sam, just keep coming back. We love you, Sam. Keep coming back. And that's what I did. So I'm the first to admit that I don't do it right. But, I mean, I do it in a way it works for me. And I don't do it right by somebody else's analysis of what right is, but I've learned a long time ago, I don't ever put my sobriety in one person's hand for sure. I put it in God's hands, but I think that if we get the message from enough people in AA, we're going to get the truth as it applies to us. I'm a firm believer I believe in the fellowship. I believe in AA, there's not a way that I think it could be better. I was reading something today, and I was considering how maybe the General Service Office ought to move out of New York. And I thought, what the hell are you thinking? You know nothing about it, and you think it ought to move out of New York. Well, that is brilliant. And so I moved on from that. I caught myself, you know, on that and said, no, Sam, you know, that's the wrong direction. But I'm pretty much in charge of people who drive incorrectly on the highways and all those things. I'm learning. You know, I'm learning about myself little by little. I'm, you know, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly, and I do firmly believe that AA is not a destination. It's, you don't get there. You don't work all those steps and then you're through and then you can go pontificate about how, you know, how much you know. I believe that, you know, it's a journey, a life journey, and if I stay on that direction, then I think that it works very well for me. It's almost 9 o'clock, I was going to tell you that, you know, we were about equal when we started out, because you didn't know what I was going to say and I didn't know what I was going to say. I'm glad that I thought of something because I like to see what I'm going to say. It kind of is a surprise sometimes. But I appreciate it. I'm telling you, this may not be, it is, and you know, it says in our literature, and I've read, you know, some of the founders who said there may be another way to do this. There may be another way to get your life going in the right direction. There may be another way to deal with your alcoholism or your addictions. But this works for me. And as long as it works for me, I'm just going to stay with it. Because I just enjoy it so much. Thank you.
Thank you, Sam, for sharing your story with us. was, you know, for somebody that didn't know what they were going to say, I'd say that came out pretty good.
We'll all be together on that broad highway.